This episode of Screen Divers was recorded prior to the passing of Urukir. He was a very memorable and eccentric character actor that starred in over 200 films. Udo, the Screen Divers salute you. Enjoy the show. This is Screen Divers. In this week's episode, we are talking about 1975, directed by Arthur Penn, Night Moves. This movie is written by Alan Sharp, produced by Robert M. Sherman, and starring Gene Hackman, Susan Clarke. And we'll stop right there, because there are many character actors we are going to discuss today. Cinematography by Bruce Surtees, edited by Didi Allen and Stephen A. Rotter, music by Michael Small, and produced by Hiller Productions LTD Leighton, distributed by Warner Brothers. This movie has a running time of 99 minutes and an undisclosed budget and box office record. How are you, Ricky?
I am quite the excellent. How are you?
I'm all right, man. I'm all right. In this week's episode, we have a very special guest, the sexy crypt keeper, the master of disaster, the boogeyman, the one that you welcome under your bed, George Healy.
Hello, gentlemen. I'm fantastic. How are you? Thank you for the wonderful and slightly frightening introduction.
We are all right, man. We are all right, and we are honored to have the host of the Horror Weekly podcast, which is one of our favorite podcasts and should be one of your favorite podcasts. What is the Horror Weekly podcast? If you don't know what it is, just go onto your favorite podcasting platform. Look for it. Just look for Horror Weekly, one word, or just go to social media and join 700 plus thousand listeners this man has managed to rake, unless they are all bots. How much are you paying that bot farm in China?
I cannot disclose. No, actually, they're all real. I'm the only bot.
Impressive AI.
A quintessential question must be asked. Ricky, what is this movie about?
Welcome to the world of Harry Mosby. He is a private investigator, self-funded, and pretty new to the game. He has been hired by a client who is from old Hollywood to find a runaway teenage daughter. And of course, like any other film noir, he then stumbles into an intriguing mess.
That's exactly what this movie is about.
That's excellent.
But it's also about Gene Hackman going on a brief holiday to the idyllic island known also as Epstein Island. Because, fuck me, man. but what are we talking about? There's a lot of controversy around this movie. We are going to get it out of the way now so that you don't let it distract you through the entire movie.
Because I was about to say, I could legally watch this film. I checked the laws in this country. How did you two get away with legally watching this film?
Age of consent. But
congratulations.
It is. It's very important. That's all right. I didn't know, Your Honor. I didn't know. No, anyway, look, the reality is that we need to get this out of the way, because otherwise it will interfere with your watch. So what are we talking about? Melanie Griffith allegedly was, how old was she?
16.
She was 16.
And this is her film debut.
There you go. And this movie was filmed, edited, completed. Everything was done in 1973. However, by the boundaries of decency, they were part of the fabric of society in 1975, where porn wasn't unionized. Someone still had the decency of avoiding some potential lawsuit by not releasing this until 1975, 2 years later. So the Melanie Griffith could be
legal.
Exactly. Yes.
I mean, but It's still a problem.
It's still a problem.
It's still icky.
Mate, it's still an issue, okay? So whatever mental gymnastics you want to avoid doing throughout watching this movie, because it will hinder your ability to enjoy this movie. So let's get it out of the way now. And if you find some solace in I'm not trying to justify any of this, but I did a watch and a half. Actually, I did half a watch and then I did a full watch. I had to fragment my first watching of this movie. And I know for a fact that I felt in a particular way that could be very common for anyone. If you've got some moral decency, you'll feel that. However, know that I had the misconception that Gene Hackman was into this. It kind of suits the movie as well, because perhaps the presentation could sway you from this, but this is sleaze. He's interacting with sleazy fucking characters. And perhaps by modern standards, they're not sleazy enough. So you could confuse this as a scenario in which everyone involved takes part in the sleaze. And guess what? Gene Hackman does not. His moralism stands him above everybody else. It's just the way he handles it. He handles it like a veteran, like someone who's been knee-deep in sleaze. Because this is a private detective, and he has. And that's where the neo-noir element of this movie comes in. And yet, he still handles it like a gentleman. So I made that mistake, but it's even honest. There's a couple of bits we will discuss in which our protagonist takes a glance. It's like a microsecond, but that's honest. And it's a problem because the movie, again, treads on strange territory. Another thing that I would like you to get out of your head, because this movie, regardless of how much you enjoy episodic drama, TV drama in particular, like Magnum P.I. or Simon and Simon, or go further to shows like Brennan, which, by the way, are connected to this as well, any of that, you may mistake this as feeling like almost like daytime TV, 1970s, 80s, 1980s rerun. It's actually much more rewarding. So stay until the end. Because if anything, and then I'll stop talking and give it to you guys, the ending of this movie reminded me, believe it or not, of Easy Rider. So I'll leave it at that.
To be safe, anyone listening to this episode should pause it now and wait 2 years and come back and finish listening to this episode, and then they'll be good.
Yeah, for sure, for sure. I didn't pick this movie. Ricky, you did not pick this movie. George, our guest, picked this movie.
Yes.
Why'd you pick this movie, George?
Well, I came by this movie by a weird path. I loved Bonnie and Clyde as a kid, and usually I track movies down by directors when I find something that I really love by them. And this one I just never watched for years and years and years. And then recently I had seen just this stray mention somewhere of how Roger Ebert had given this movie two vastly different reviews. One semi-positive with a lot of reservations and one much, much more positive later in his career. And then someone else called it one of the Holy Trinity of crime of film noir detective movies from the 70s, which would be Chinatown, Long Goodbye, and Night Moves. And I was like, oh, I've never seen Night Moves. I should watch that. Then I saw it's by Arthur Penn, and I'm like, what? And I ended up absolutely loving the movie and thinking it's fantastic. But it's nothing that I ever could have covered on Horror Weekly. I can bend myself into some pretzels to get some horror adjacent stuff on there, but this would never have qualified. So this is my chance.
we're your conduit.
I mean, I'm just glad that you picked it. Ricky, what's your history with this movie?
I believe this may have been my first viewing. I'm trying to piece things together in my brain of whether I've seen this before. If I had, it would have been so long ago, and it would have been something that I saw on late night television. So I'm just going to say that this was my first viewing.
Likewise, this was my first viewing.
Interesting. There's a theory about this movie, actually, that no one can appreciate it on one first viewing, that it's the second and third viewing is where it really grows. So I'm really curious to see what you guys made of it now, since it's your first viewings. I didn't know that coming into this.
Circumstance dictates that I got to watch this movie a time and a half. Yeah. And that's almost twice. And that helped, because on the second view, I actually decided to watch this from the beginning on the second viewing. Anna was beside me, so she watched it with me. And by the end of it, Anna said something super poignant. Anna is very stoic. She's Norwegian. So this is high praise. Because at some point, I may have said that to her. I said, I don't think you're going to enjoy. I was arrogant enough to assume that. And I said to her earlier this week, I said, I don't think you're going to enjoy this one. Credits are rolling. And she goes, why did you think I wasn't going to enjoy this? So we both were in all the way. To the point in which, In the third act of this movie, we were both like throwing assumptions. You know, like at one point I had it. I turned around to Anna and was like, yeah, of course, that's, you know, we're going to get to that. But I thought I had it. And then it took us for a ride twice. So it's, I thoroughly enjoyed this, man. I, in regards to my history with this, this was my first viewing. I mean, I was enjoying it on the first watch as well, but for different reasons. And also, again, I appeal to our listeners, and I'll do it again for the last time. Please toss all the controversy about this movie aside if you can, because it will hinder your ability to enjoy it. So it's very important. But I wanted to talk about something else. This movie speaks a very strange language. And, I mean, at least that was my experience with this. I spent the past 24 hours role-playing a private dick. I had to investigate. I literally, all the factoids that I will throw on the table today are, and it's usually like that anyway, we don't go, the only data we throw at you is at the beginning of each episode. That's when numbers are thrown at you and whatever else, but we don't scour for factoids online. We hunt for them based on the viewing. And in this instance, I had to do a little bit of it. You guys want to hear some of the stuff I found?
Absolutely.
So the movie opens. We have Harry Mosby walking into his office. And I was fascinated by the tack in this movie, which, by the way, it really puts this movie above a lot of other movies from the 70s. There's a lot of technology that is fresh tack in here. And instead of having a typical neo-noir or no, sorry, a typical, actually, this could be considered neo-noir, technically. I hate those words when they come together to form that expression. But it is a neo-noir. However, some of the language and some of the conversations and the beat and the rhythm of those conversations are very like 1940s, 1930s noir, you could argue. We're going to talk about that as well. But in regards to the tech in this, as soon as the movie opens, Mosby walks into his office. And there's a piece of tech on the desk, which I adored. I sent a picture to you, Ricky, and I sent a picture to you, George. And I will put a picture of the 1970-something advert for the piece of tech in question. Mm-hmm. It is an extremely, really cool and chunky answering machine, the Codafone 700. Again, go to our Facebook page and take a look at the photo so you get an idea if you haven't seen the movie yet. Now, why is this important? Actually, it does take center stage because the first few lines of dialogue uttered in this movie come out of that answer machine.
Babe, how I hate these goddamn machines. This Nick, babe, I got one for you, Aaron. He's a real-life detective and not one of our computers. The lady called Arlene Iverson. She's looking to get a daughter home. She's an old friend of mine here. Used to be in the movies, maybe remember. Take your chance. job, stop by the office tonight. I'll give you what stuff we have on our lead, okay? Bye-bye, puffs.
The opening of this movie is the beginning of the smoke and mirrors, is the beginning of the misdirection that will be thrown at you, all right? And just like our protagonist, Harry Mosby, you will be going for a ride. You'll be going around in circles. Literally.
Yes.
But, and then later on, we get another piece of tech, which is the equivalent of a briefcase with a recorder in it, which could have easily, that all of that exposition could have been given to you by a voiceover. And that wasn't done here. But technically, that's what that recorder does. And it's a very clever little thing to do for the director so that we don't fall into the cliche that is brought on by a voiceover, even if it belongs in this movie, because it is a noir tale.
And it gives Gene Hackman the chance to do facial responses to what he's hearing from the recorder. And his acting in that scene is phenomenal.
There's a lot. If you are enthralled and fascinated by the allure of Gene Hackman as an actor and his feature, his most coveted feature, which is what could be called the Duchenne smile. What is the Duchenne smile? Go fucking look it up. Gene Hackman always resembled possibly another actor. His acting style is Cagney, as close as it gets, probably. But he did have this smiling in anger kind of thing. It's a very menacing smile, because right after the smile, you're either getting punched or you're getting tortured. Something's going to happen.
I would say, actually, there was a little less of that in this one, that his smile was actually more on the fact that, hey, you're about to give me some information, but you don't realize you're about to drop this fact to me. And I think I understand that whole, what you were explaining, because he has that with, would you believe James Woods is in this film? And James Woods gets a proper beating, almost off-screen and on-screen, on a regular basis throughout this film. But
he gets kicked under a car on wheels. It's amazing.
It's fucking great. It's great. You could have put some Benny Hill music behind that one, by the way. And he does some pole vaulting in this. There's a lot of action.
Riding off on a bike really fast.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Almost like, woo.
This is an athletic Gene Hackman, man. He makes that polo shirt look just right. Which, by the way, I picked for the titling of our promo reel on social media. I picked this like turquoise kind of teal color for a screen. That's Gene Hackman's t-shirt in this in this movie. That's a tribute to his polo shirt. There you go. But why is the beginning of this movie important? And it goes back to the meeting that he has with his handler, or whatever you want to call it. Now, his handler is played by, and I know that this is one of the two. Okay, listeners, we have a rule. We don't talk about the movie before we record. However, I fell into the pitfalls of having a conversation with George. he likes to talk on the phone, and so do I. So that phone call later
I'm excited about what you're about to do, because the actor I was talking about the actor I'm talking about is not the actor you're about to name.
I know, but I know what the other actor is. I know who the other actor is. All right, but I'm not gonna take that away from you. So I'm stealing one of them. The actor
I might steal it.
Well, yes, you may, because there's another character actor that's been everywhere, and that's got to be the one that he's going to mention. But anyway, we're going to fuck each other over at different points of this recording, so it's fine. It's okay. Someone's going to die at the end of this episode for sure.
No, that's a different podcast, mate. Let's.
should I put the fucking music, like the fighting music, you know, the Star Trek fight between Shatner and Leonard Nimoy? Fucking hell, man. All right.
The worst ending of this episode is someone's going to get checkmated. Go ahead.
For sure. Somebody's hard drive's going to get checked by the FBI.
Yeah, it's going to be yours.
It's going to be George's because this is his favorite movie. And they're closer to him. They're going to get him first, right?
That's right.
They're going to find whatever folder I shared with him. They're going to come to me. Then they're going to come to me, and I'm going to tie them to you.
Your faith in their competence is touching.
For sure. Now, the actor in question is Kenneth Mars. Who is Kenneth Mars? Kenneth Mars plays his handler. Now, we mentioned Kenneth Mars in this podcast before because I tied him to a role that he was somehow memorable in a season of Malcolm in the Middle. Kenneth Mars plays Otto, who's the German Bavarian, I think, Bavarian rancher, who basically is introduced to the audience because Francis, one of the older brothers in the Malcolm in the Middle family, goes to work at. And he's memorable. He's really funny. And you could argue that he's comedic here. He brings some comedic relief somehow, just his presence. But also, recently we talked about him, because he was the marshal in Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid.
Oh, there you go.
Yes, he was. He was. Mm-mm-mm. Anyway, he appears here and there, and he's a very good character actor. I really want to touch the other one and steal it from you. You know what? Let's do it. George, who is the character actor you want to talk about?
It's not so much a character actor. It's the fact that there's a science fiction movie that I'm so obsessed with that it ended up being on our Letterboxd list of the best 100 horror movies ever made. And it's total bullshit. Like, it's not horror. And I can't take it off the list because I love it so much. It's Colossus the Forbin Project. And Susan Clark, who plays Gene Hackman's wife in this movie, is the co-star of Colossus the Forbin Project, which I had no idea was the case until I did research on it. Like, it just blew my mind that I didn't recognize her.
Okay, I'm going to add to that, because Ricky must be happy, because it's not the one, right? Ricky is not the character. It is?
It was.
Because you don't know what I'm going to say now. And this actually popped out of recognition for her. Like, I didn't have to look for this. Do you know why I know Susan Clark?
Is it because of her TV series?
Webster?
Yep. That's what I was going for.
That's amazing.
Here it is. And maybe you don't listen. Maybe you don't know this. All right? And your heads, our listeners' heads, the world's going to explode now. Okay?
Okay.
So we can actually hear cicadas in the background in Australia.
Yes. So.
There might be mole crickets.
Because there's a scene in the middle of Night Moves where there's no dialogue and you just hear insects for like 90 full seconds. So this is perfect.
Oh, yeah. So Susan Clark and the factoid that is going to blow your minds, right? Why were we talking about Kenneth Mars? Why were we talking about that opening sequence in which he goes to see what's the name of the guy that gives him jobs here and there? Because he doesn't want to join an agency, so he takes jobs whenever he wants to.
Oh, like Nick or Rick or something?
Nick. It's Nick. So he's in Nick's office. He goes to take the job at the beginning of the movie right after listening to the answering machine message, which, by the way, it shows as well that that's new technology because the answering machine message opens with, I hate these things. Because they are fresh tech for people. You know, like they've been around, but extremely expensive. People are not used to talking on the phone. So it's everything's important here. But anyway, in the office, they're having an exchange. Nick gets up as he's talking about the situation. And right after that exchange, or right before that exchange ends, he points out at a glass cabinet And in the glass cabinet, there's a bunch of, what would you call it? I think it describes it as Mexican art, basically. You know, the little statuettes or whatever. And the contraband, which is connected to, you know, where the movie will go eventually. But he says to him, he asks for approval because he's collecting these things. And he says to Harry, he goes, you like them? And Harry goes, nah, they remind me of Alex Karras. Now, why? Who is Alex Karras? Alex Karras for, I had to look this up, right? And maybe embedded in, and because I forgot as well, because we get to that, but I am, of course, familiar with him. But I don't know about his background. And for in most popular culture, he would be known because, Ricky, apparently he was a wrestler as well at some point in his career. Mm-hmm. But he was an NFL player. And why does Harry dislike him? Because Harry was an NFL player. So the movie never holds your hand. This movie, there's a lot of hidden shit in it. But if you dig, you'll find little nuggets of gold. So why? Why does he hate Alex Karras? Well, Alex Karras was well known for being quite tough, right? Like a tough player. And guess what? There is one bit in this movie. If you pay close attention later on, there's a moment when Harry Mosby goes to talk to the stunt coordinator for the first time. He goes to talk to Marv for the first time. He exits a trailer where he's staying at. And as he exits the trailer, he lands on his right leg or whatever, and you can see him slightly wince a little. And then as he enters the car, he grabs his leg. If you blink, you miss it. But there's no other conversation that talks about the reason what fucked his career, what fucked his NFL career. And it's all given to you within seconds. And it's no dialogue about it. Correct? Did you notice this?
Correct.
Right. Okay. Correct.
And also the guy that is sleeping with his wife, that his wife's cheating on him with, uses a cane. Right? So this gimpy leg motif is in this movie a couple times, actually.
Of course, everyone's wounded, either emotionally or physically in this movie. There's generational trauma, all the characters experience it. There's impotence being shown by people that want something they cannot obtain. There's a lot, but we talk about that. That's why we're here today. However, why is this Alex Karras important here? And this is the mind-blowing fact. To go back to Webster, the father was played by Alex Karras. And guess what? Yes. So the mother in Webster was made years later in 1985. The mother was Susan Clark, and the father was played by Alex Karras. But it goes further than that, because Alex Karras and Susan Clark were married in real life.
Yes.
And why is this mind-blowing? Because in 1973, when this movie was made, Susan Clark and Alex Karras didn't fucking know each other.
Again, every day, Pepe's mail's getting sent back to me. Pepe, Sylvia, Pepe, Sylvia. I look in the mail. Well, this whole box is Pepe, Sylvia. So I say to myself, I gotta find this guy. I gotta go up to his office. I gotta put his mail in the guy's goddamn hands. Otherwise, he's never gonna get it. He's gonna keep it.
Yes. So the joke hits twice as much because Alex Karras ends up in fucking his movie wife in real life. It's Inception.
This movie predicted the future.
I checked, man. Alex Karras and Susan Clark didn't even know each other. They started dating in 75 because they worked together on the set of something else. But the movie was made in 73. So it was pen and paper, man. Pen and paper.
Your sleuthing is impressive, but also it makes you wonder if they, whatever name they had mentioned, if she would just end up marrying whatever name they had said. She's lucky they said someone she liked.
Yeah, imagine if they said Sam Spade. They do. There's actually quite a lot of references to classic noir films and characters throughout this. At one point, Sam Spade is mentioned.
Yes, true.
There's even points where
Can you tell our listeners, in case they don't know who Sam Spade was, the fictional character?
Yeah, well, you know what they need.
Maltese Falcone.
They need to educate themselves. Yeah, exactly. Come on, we can only screen dive so much, and then we get the bends. You know, it's
okay. Aren't we the Uber nerds? We are the Uber nerds, right? So let us do the work.
But And also, yeah, Harry gets sort of taunted on many occasions, being like, hey, are you just saying that because you think that's what a private eye is meant to say? And it also points out actually what an amateur he is. He hasn't got his own firm is independent. But the whole point I feel like about the intro to this whole film is to prove that he's good at his job, because he has his own personal case, let's call it, that he needs to solve that involves his wife. And to begin with, you see his wife go to the cinema.
She goes with two people, right? Because one is the one is the fake out guy, and the other one is the Marty Heller, the one she's having the affair with.
No, but they're friends, and he's gay. Because it's a typical cliche. It's an antique dealer, right? And Gene Hackman tells a story just by going, hey, when are we going bowling next time? Because it's a macho thing to do.
We also get introduced then, as was mentioned, Marty Heller, which is played by Harris Yulin. And we are very wise to mention Ghostbusters 2. He is the judge who loses his cool.
Peter Venkman, Raymond Stans, Egon Spengler, stand up! Get up!
You too, Mr. Tully.
Find you guilty on all charges. Order you to pay fines in the amount of $25,000 each. To send you to 18 months in the city correctional facility at Rikers Island.
Evie, she's twitching.
I'm not finished!
On a more personal note, let me just go on record as saying that there's no place for fake charlatans.
Your Honor?
Shut up! Fixers like you! In decent society.
Your Honor, this is important.
You play on the gullibility of innocent people.
Yes, sir.
Be quiet.
But
my hands were signed by the unalterable fetters of the law.
But Clear and Present Danger, Training Day, Scarface. Mm-hmm.
Scarface, he played Bernstein in it.
Yeah.
And he was Buddy in The Ozark, if you remember. Mm-hmm. More recently. And I know him very well because I watch Frasier at nauseam. There's a very very good episode of Frasier. I can't remember which season, but where he plays a mobster. And the mobster's called Jerome Belasco. He's a fantastic character actor. The moment you see his face, you remember him. The problem is that he has some features that may confuse him a little with Hopkins, with Udo Kier. Like, it's got something, something about his face. Yeah, there's something about his face. Yeah.
Udo Kier, brilliant.
Well, do you disagree?
Like, no. It's more, it's spot on. I didn't think of Udo Kier until you said it, but I was like, yeah, you're right, Udo Kier, yeah.
Yeah, but in regards to him, we lost him this year, and nobody noticed. We lost him in June 2025.
That's a shame.
He was 87 when he passed, so... Yeah, it's a shame. But there's a lot of actors of this generation that are fucking dying. That's, you know. And I hate to say it, but that's a good run. Because if you think for a second any of us will last to 87, you are a fucking fool. It's not happening. I don't think we get that far.
No, not at all. Definitely
if not. You're here talking to me, that means we have kinship, and that means you fucked around. So,
are we going to say our spoiler warning yet?
Yeah, I definitely think we should do a let. So we're going to do some spoilers from this point on. So if you, the thing is, this is a detective story where solving the detective cases is one of the least important plot elements. So I don't think spoilers are like that ruinous for this movie. But if you care, you should probably avoid from here and come back once you've seen it.
Again, if you're hell-bent on, you know, listening to the rest of the episode right now, I don't think it would devalue your enjoyment. Feel of the movie, it's late 70s, and that's a good thing because it's good top shelf 70s. And we talk about the ending of this movie, which is that very melancholic, like a proper tragic 1970s ending. And at the beginning of this podcast, I said that that's to me that's akin to to Easy Rider. Because Easy Rider has a very, no matter the journey, this will end badly for the protagonist. And the ending will be some kind of cautionary tale, you know. We have that happening the other way around in the 80s with a movie like Paris, Texas. Paris, Texas is an 80s movie with a 70s ending, in my opinion, which is, you know, with that flavor. And that's good, but it requires investment on your part as the viewer, because this movie will throw all this misdirection, not only in its plot and narrative at you, but it would also tonally will fool you, because the last fucking 10 minutes of this movie are like Don't Look Now kind of, you know, it's heavy shit. If you look deep into it, it will show you all the unresolved arcs, all the unresolved lives of the people that you got to meet. Like, nobody learns anything here. If anything, they pay a price, and it's a dear one. But they're all cautionary tales, all of them.
One of the reasons this movie excites me is I'm kind of obsessed with this idea that there are really controlled types of filmmaking, like what Kubrick did. And then there's the kind of movie that kind of accidentally succeeds a little bit, where it gets away from the people making it a little bit, and they kind of make something great despite themselves or a little bit sideways. This one is different because the writer, Alan Sharp, was one of the most fatalistic, bleak kind of like creators you can imagine. And Arthur Penn, the director, is relatively optimistic, right? He thinks that change is possible, you can make the world a better place, etc. So these two things clash in this movie, and it makes the movie a hybrid. And I don't think either of them wanted it to be a hybrid. So when the ending is ambiguous, it feels ambiguous because you have two heavyweight creative people arm wrestling, and they arm wrestle each other to a draw. So, like, one of the things that's really fascinating to me about this is not only does it match, like, because, you know, Alan Sharp said he got the idea for this when it doesn't matter, the origin story is interesting, but he said he wanted to do a detective story where solving the detective case was one of the least important things. And so the solving of it isn't really the key part. As a matter of fact, near the end of the movie, Jennifer Warren's character turns to Gene Hackman and says, "You're asking all the wrong questions." Right? So it's not the solving of it so much that's going to matter. What matters is America was directionless after Watergate and the 70s, like the way it turned. And this movie ends directionlessly. And I don't think they did that entirely on purpose, mostly on purpose. But I think it's also because they were each trying to get their hands on the steering wheel of this movie, and neither of them quite succeeded, and I think it's better for it.
Well, they crashed into success.
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
The kudos to you for bringing this to the table. Normally we give six options to our guests, and then you pick one, so you get the illusion of choice. You mentioned that you had this desire to, you know, it wasn't an imposition at all. You showed excitement in that phone call when you mentioned this. And I went, you know what? Fuck that. Fuck our process. We'll go for that.
I love it.
And you went, okay. And you know why you went okay? Yeah. Because you are starved. Yeah. You were starved because you want to cover anything that isn't full-on horror. And you don't get to do that on your podcast. Yes. You come here to do it.
That's 100% true. That's 100% true. That's 100% true.
We are your mistress.
I'm cheating on my own podcast here.
But did you really stray that far from your territory?
I didn't, because there's some horrifying shit in this movie.
The ending of this movie is haunting. My mouth was open because I was excited. I was like, oh, shit. Yes, my investment, my 1.5 days of investment in this have paid off. The ending of this movie is phenomenal. And again, I plea with our listeners, if you jump into this and if you have any preconceptions about anything that didn't come out fucking last week, first of all, you have a problem. Talk to somebody. But fix it. Because if you don't look back, your ability to look forward would be diminished. You really need to look back. There's a lot of good stuff behind you. Yeah. So watch that. So that your appreciation for anything that comes in the future will be diminished. it will become a burden.
We mentioned earlier a few other noir or revivalist noir classics from this time period. And I really think that it's a shame that, I mean, I know we understand the reason why they held up on releasing this film, but it's such a shame because between the time of making this film and releasing this film, we got Chinatown. Following something like Chinatown, where you have a perfect revisionistic film noir, which does take you all around the houses before it like hits you with what the actual plot is. To have a film released after Chinatown, which is very similar, and there are so many good aspects of this film, it does it lives in its shadow. And it's such a shame, because if I had seen this film before Chinatown, I would have been like, oh, blah, blah. And, you know, brain exploded all over the place. But I think in the shadow of Chinatown, I can see its good elements. But it's such a shame it came out after Chinatown.
Arthur Penn said when this movie failed and helped to ruin his career, he said really ruefully, we were a few years too late. He thought this movie would have done better before, but we should also mention that this movie got crushed by Jaws, right? This movie, Jaws came out a week and a half after this movie. Because this movie was delayed, it was double doomed, right? Because not only did Chinatown get the jump on it, but Jaws crushed it in the box office.
And this is before home video, right? So you're not going to... You're not going to recoup until later, much later.
And imagine making a movie this fucking good and having it be a career ender, right? Because Arthur Penn's career got crushed by this.
Do you guys know when the Polanski scandal reached its climax, like the highest point? Because that rocked Hollywood.
Yeah, I feel like the Polanski scandal was around the Six Window or...
Because, you know, the decision to hold this back, obviously already you had some kind of industry standards that had to be followed so you don't get arrested. But they played fast and loose with a lot of stuff in this movie. The problem is the discrepancy in age between every other actor and her. That's the thing. But the movie is alluding to that. So that's why they casted a young Melanie Griffith in it. Because Tom Iverson, this piece of shit, is a real scumbag. And I want to talk about the illusions. I mean, at least this is my assumption as the viewer. I really like Jennifer Warren's character. This movie put Jennifer Warren on the map for me. She's in some instances, she's beautiful in this movie. And there's a fragility that shows, a sense of humor, but she plays Paula. Now, there is a moment, and I love that this movie does this just with glances sometimes, you know, like short sentences and glances, and there's an entire backstory without dumping all this exposition on you. You put it together yourself. There's a moment in which, just with a glance, at least this is what I picked up, I got a sense that Paula's character was putting up with Tom's bullshit and the young girl being around, because he's a despicable man. Like, he's not only a smuggler, he has allegiances to nobody. And he's a pedophile. There's shades of incest here because he's a stepfather. And it's obviously, it's not uttered out loud, but it's hinted at several times that he has had sex with her several times. And there's a moment in which you get a glance from her and you think, did Paula suffer the same? That's why she's dealing with the shit, because she suffered the same fate. He did this con. He pulled this con before, and she was the kid that got in the crossfire and still lives with him.
Definitely. When Gene Hackman says to her, like, what did you do before this? She gives a litany of her history. And when she's done saying the things that she's done, he says, that sounds kind of bleak. Or is it just the way you tell it? Right?
I like Gene Hackman's rebuttal. In the third act of this movie, he says something to her. He goes, I had enough of your ping pong bullshit. No, ping pong talk bullshit, I think that's. Yeah. It's a great line. There's a lot of great lines in this, man. And one of my favorites, the one that kind of kept me investigating throughout the movie, is to try and understand what the fuck Edward Beans is doing in this. The actor, the character actor, Edward Beans, plays Joy Ziegler. We mentioned him briefly earlier. He's the stunt coordinator. And we're jumping around here, and we will continue to jump around. So catch up. I have an accent as well, so I'm making your task even more difficult. But in case, I'll speak slower if I can, but I doubt it. They're in the bar, and it's the first proper exchange between Joey and Harry. Everything that comes out of this guy's mouth is like some sort of platitude. He speaks in idioms, and it's a very like 1930, 1940 noir thing to do, which never to speak directly about something. Like he, and one of the things he says to him, he goes, "Do you think that that Delilah, that Deli knew about this and that she told somebody?" It's like, of course she told somebody. She's not Lillian Gish. I had to fucking put this joke together. What do you mean by she's not Lillian Gish? Lillian Gish was a famous silent era actress. And this means that, of course, she talked because Lillian Gish didn't talk in her movies. I had to fucking – it's a puzzle. Yeah. And there's a lot of stuff like this, mate. Like, I didn't get it.
Well, it's one of the things, honestly, that I like most about the movie is that there's a lot of truly adult conversations that you don't see in movies very often, right? The way these people are talking to each other is really, like – At a high level adult. There's an amazing moment near the end of this movie when Gene Hackman is talking to his wife and she goes, you know, he goes, you know, I know when you feel like I'm absent, you reach out. Then he stops himself and he goes, we reach out for other people. And she starts to tell him like this and he goes, no, no, I didn't mean just you. And she says, I know what you didn't mean. These people are talking to each other at but like really sophisticated level, but not like academic sophisticated language. They're talking like real people, but like real people who are like digging for truth and can't get there, you know.
Yeah, they're married, so there's an emotional layer that is, you know, very adult in their exchanges. But that's not my favorite, man. My favorite is in the kitchen. When they're having an argument at one point, she goes, and this is one of the you know, there's almost like physical confrontation because there's a lot of passion from both parties here. He smashes a glass. They're at the height of the argument. And she goes, stop it. I can't hear myself think.
He turns off the garbage disposal and goes, and he says, lucky you. And the movie has the wisdom to pause on it. They just stare at each other after that. There's one part that I love when he first discovers that his wife is cheating on him, and she comes home and she doesn't know he knows yet, and he's hiding upstairs in like an attic situation watching a tiny TV, and he's watching a football game, and she goes, who's winning? And he goes, nobody's winning. Each side is losing slowly, right? Or something like that. Yes. There are really, really great, smart, poignant lines that these people are saying to each other, but they don't lead anywhere, right? Like in a typical movie, you would drop a one-liner and it would be a wisdom chunk. But like one thing about this movie that's fascinating is like, so think of like in this movie, who's the role model? What character would you pick in this movie that you'd be like, if I had to choose someone in this movie that I'm going to live my life the way they live their life, who would you pick?
The way they live their life? There are no role models here.
There are no role models. Because nobody's getting anywhere.
Can I tell you something? And I'm going to get in trouble probably for this. But there's a moment in which the first time Harry Mosby, Poops. Let's call him Poops because that's what Nick calls him at the beginning of this. No, Harry. Because they're friends, right? So he calls him affectionately. He calls him Poops. I'm gonna call you Poops, Ricky. What? You want me to call him Poops?
No.
Okay. Fair enough. Anyway, he goes, Harry, after he takes the job, goes to see Arlene. Again, another kind of despicable, tragic figure, though. She's despicable until she's a tragic figure. I placed a lot of blame. When I thought I had this movie, I placed all the blame on her for a second, you know. But he goes to her house. And that kind of shocked me because I'm not fucking with you. Patricia Quinn.
It's astounding. Time is fleeting. Madness. takes its toll. But listen closely.
Not for very much longer.
I've got to keep control.
You know Patricia Quinn because she played Magenta in the Rocky Horror Picture Show. She's also featured in some of Rob Zombie's movies. And Patricia Quinn happened to be married to a friend of mine who's now dead. A very, very close friend. Oh, wow. Marcus, this episode goes to you, mate. Marcus was, I met him in the goth scene years ago, and he was one of my closest friends. Because of life, we didn't see each other as often. And he was married. He got married to Patricia Quinn, much younger, like 30 years younger, almost. And Patricia, obviously, has been not at the top of her game for many, many years. And at one point, I went to see Marcus because he told me that he was unwell. This took him 2 months. Later on, he passed. But I went to visit him, and I went to his house because he was living with her. And they lived in Primrose Hill. Primrose Hill could be categorized as a posh area here in London. That's where a lot of actors, a lot of artists live. Yeah. And it's overlooking a park. This apartment's overlooking a park. I walk in, and the decor. the smell as well inside the place was kind of musty, like, because it feels like something that was decorated with a lot of effort about 40 years ago.
Right.
When the career was paying off. So I walked into a time capsule. Yeah. And on top of the piano, they had a piano there, like a white piano, which is what Arlene has in her fucking living room. There's photos from a bygone era. You know, and you look around the apartment, and there's photos and mementos and tributes to a bygone era. You know, and that to me, and not only that, but the double window overlooking that scenery is overlooking the park in Primrose Hill. The moment I watched this, I was like, oh shit, it's, you know, the unfortunate career is now gone kind of scenario. And
that's crazy.
It's crazy. And also the drunkenness and the meanness when the alcohol's in the mix, all of that, very, very akin to that situation.
There's a real Norma Desmond feel to that. Wow. That's wild.
What could happen to anybody? I guess the 1% is the one that manages to keep the same momentum throughout their career in that industry. It's, you know, particularly for a woman, it would be very difficult. Yeah. Very difficult.
I would say that some of my favorite, I mean, like this is full of great lines. I was looking for a list, and he'd fuck a woodpile on the chance there was a snake in it. That's a great one.
See, that's again,
The
way the guy spoke, right? Yeah, it's right. Fantastic.
That's great. Or like, you know, the whole story about having, you know, I got touched by a guy and my nipple stayed erect for half an hour afterwards. Oh, the shame. You know,
that's also, that hits back later when he goes, enough of your ping-pong talk bullshit.
Yeah, yeah.
And he goes, you lied about this, this, and this. He takes a pause and he goes, and your erected nipples.
Yeah.
Yep.
And again, Harry thinks if you call him Harry again, he's going to make you eat the cat.
If you call me Harry again, I'm going to make you eat your cat.
But my favorite line, for sure, that killed all of them and was really simple, which was, it should be against the law. It is.
Harry, you're a pretty straight guy. And I'm going to tell you, I want that kid the hell out of here. You see, I got pretty foolish with her, and you've seen her. God, there ought to be a law.
There is.
And there's something about this film where you know the dialogue. They definitely wrote and they put this together in love of classic noir, but they could get away with saying the F word. They could get away with actually saying it's incest. They could get away with saying it's child prostitution. There's so much about this that is so 70s revival, where they go, oh, you know what they didn't used to talk about? Here we go. We're going to talk about it all in this film. And I think that's what the classicness of this film is that it can take something as classic as a film noir and just put it's like 70s weird, we shouldn't really be telling the kids. And I can't believe it was only an M rating.
Oh no! On the IMDb is maybe over there, but it's
maybe in Australia. It's an X. Oh, really? In Australia, yeah. It was an M rating.
Yeah, but the rating system is different over there, and it's different in the UK as well, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But if you look on IMDb, there's an X on it.
Oh wow! Because like that means over here it was 15 plus, basically. So it could be a 15 in the UK, but
maybe it changed over time. Maybe it changed over time. Yeah. You know. One thing to note is, you know, I mentioned how much, I mean, I praise it at least. I think that this is, it actually aids the movie to keep it on the edge of the 70s tech-wise, you know. Tech-wise, like I said, this feels like an 82, 83. There's one thing that Harry does when he goes to Marty's house, which is Harry, played by Harry Yulin, it's basically another foray into investigating his wife and what she's doing with this dude, and he does it in the most facetious way possible. He walks in, he sits down, pours himself some wine, puts on the music, and right after that little bit of degustation on what's on the table, he decides to put the volume up, right? And when Marty comes out, he turns around to Marty and in most, again, facetious as fuck, he goes, "Is this one of the new Advent speakers that I heard so much about?" Sounds great. And I looked it up. Yes, apparently this company that then, you know, a few years later went bust, ran from 1967 to 1981. This Advent speakers were like avant-garde speakers that were popular for a second. Wow. They're mentioned in this movie.
There's so much product placement in this. And the fact that it's distributed by Warner Brothers and James Woods at one point goes, "I don't know, some sort of Warner Brothers flick," while he's getting beaten up.
Yes. What happened to your face?
I won second prize in a fight.
Where was the last place you saw Deli?
In New Mexico. Easy. I went down there on a job, a movie location. Something for Warner Brothers. Deli went with me. There was a guy, one of the stuntmen. Deli started hitting on him. When I left, he stayed on.
Fuck, man. James Woods is so hammy in this as well. Like, and he's the most important character here, by the way. Yeah. I think you can see if James Wood overacts always, he's always like, I think he was Sir David Joshua Smith. in his last adventure with us, he came on for Raising Cain. If you didn't hear that episode, go back and go listen to it. But he mentioned something. We were talking about how John Lithgow is, you know, can really dial it up, but he can also dial it down. And James, we were talking about overacting sometimes, and James Woods is you know, definitely guilty of that. I love him, but that's the very quality I love about him. But in this movie, he acts something out very well, maybe because he takes it over the line, and it's contempt. He hates Marv because he has the life that for whatever reason he cannot have. He is a mechanic in the stunt world, and yet he rides a motorcycle, and he dresses edgy, and he wants to, but he doesn't get to do any of that shit. He gets to be the mechanic for someone who does that shit. And on top of that, because of this continuous longing for and looking for peril that gives him that edge, he gets himself fucking killed because he gets manipulated by other people that technically are not predators here. They're just cons, you know, they're trying to be cons, and he's at the bottom of that chain, which doesn't give him much luster in this, you know. And I think Harry knows that. That's why he treats him with such a...
Can I say something just a little different about this character? So James Woods' character, I think, and I'm not sure that I believe this, but let's say it's a possibility. I'll be curious to what you guys think. He might have the clearest vision of anybody in this movie, because here's the thing. Gene Hackman is being used as an accomplice to murder, right? Why is Arlene sending him to go recover her daughter? She wants her daughter back so she can get the money, right? So Gene Hackman is being used, right? So when Gene Hackman's character brings Melanie Griffith back and drops her off at the house, James Woods is there. And the mom is screaming, and Melanie Griffith is upstairs screaming. And what does James Woods say to Gene Hackman's character? He says to Mosby, "You'll just bring her back and drop her off here? You don't care what you're dropping her into, do you?" I think he knows this detective has put her in more danger, not less. I think part of why he's so angry is he thinks they should just break free and live free and be on the run. and this spider web keeps pulling them back in. And it gets her, it gets him, it gets almost everybody in this movie. But James Woods' character is the only one who has the sense to try to escape for a little bit, right? Like, the rational response to being in the situation of this movie is to run. And he's the only one really running. Everyone else is trying to catch each other or keep each other tied to each other. I think James Woods' character sees more than you would expect from his outward kind of demeanor.
Well, regardless of what he sees, he's an accessory to it all, and he also gets killed. And it's also symbolism where he's found. He's found in the little pen with the two other dolphins, and there's one thing that comes out of Paula's mouth that goes, oh, some people keep them as pets. Remember that shit?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. And guess what Arlene had? It was very prominent in every shot. She had a pool.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes.
I don't know. Sorry. That's what I saw.
I'm really curious what you guys made of Mosby's final confrontation with Arlene, with Melanie Griffith's mother, when he comes back and confronts her drunk at the pool.
Okay. Well, I thought it was exactly what it needed to be. Because this film is full of MacGuffins, and Arlene was always a MacGuffin because she had no power in any of the games. So the conversation, the drunken conversation that is telling him little bits of truths, but also it's all garbled because she's always drunk all the time. It's exactly what it needed to be. It needed to be just misdirection for a detective trying to find the truth. So I saw it just that conversation as another MacGuffin for leading up to the finale.
Interesting.
It was a roller coaster, the conversation for me. It was a roller coaster because at the beginning you are with what starts as a needed retribution that you crave for this character, but then it goes straight into violence. There's a amount of violence in the verbiage there that is dished out to her that it almost gets to a point, it gets too much, and then it reverses your emotion for it. Like I was on Gene Hackman's motorcycle until a certain point, because he goes to, you are there because she is a terrible mother. And of course, whatever cycle this woman has gone through is perpetrated onto her teenage daughter. And fucking Harry has no qualms about pointing this out because it's very true. But the moment that truth hits, you feel the impact. And that started turning into pity for me, because then she's allowed to give some sort of rebuttal that it's tragic and it's super sensical in this scenario, you know, because that's how things went and they still go. She goes, I spent more time on my knees in this industry. And you can feel that this woman is being driven by whatever desire for fame and a career in the industry. She got driven to this fucking life. And I felt for her. Yes, still a terrible mother. But still, Delilah is the product of somebody else's trauma. So it's generational. That's one thing that Ricky said. I mean, Ricky says a lot of poignant shit in this podcast. I'm the clown here. But that's why you're here. And one of the things that he said recently was about generational trauma. It was in the Unforgiven episode. Mm. And you said that movie could also be categorized as a diorama of trauma for everybody, like fucking Oprah going, and you get trauma, and you get trauma. And guess what? Yeah, in this instance, fuck me. Like George said, everybody's going through some shit, you know, but you got to pick one, you know, which protagonist we're going to go with Harry, because it's fucking Gene Hackman and he's the protagonist of this movie. But everyone has a very sad arc. If you think Gene Hackman comes through unscathed at the end of this, not only is the most unlucky man in the universe because he took a shot from a spraying Uzi from a fucking plane. You can't eat shit like this. You know what I mean?
Yes, yes.
Steve, where are you, Steve? He could have told us, oh, there's no realism here. Of course there isn't. It's a fucking fact that he takes a shot in the leg is insanity. But the very thing that he's doing at the end, you could attribute that to everything. You could even go as far as thinking, who is the bastard that is invoking during this trial in time? As the boat goes around this scene, like, yes, it could be an SOS. It could be perceived an SOS by any other plane going over this route. But in the meantime, there's a symbolism of him going in circles. And throughout this movie, that's what he does. He goes around in circles. Yeah. But also, who is the bastard? Could it be his father? Because there is a very, that's the thing as well, the story that he shares with his wife and the dismay almost that goes from dismay to feeling sorry for him. This woman goes through a tornado of emotions when he tells her that truth that he never told her. Because for a second, the greatest desire this woman had, possibly the greatest appeal this woman found when she met Harry, was that she could fix him. Mm. And guess what? You ain't going to fix shit if you didn't know what the real problem was. So
right.
Go ahead.
I was gonna say, though, this has the same thing as Butch Cassidy and Sundance Kid, which is his conversation with Ellen is the Cassandra moment. It's the, I just have to finish this case. No, you don't. Actually, if you don't finish this case, you'll be all right. If you actually just don't get on that plane. She says, I hate airports. I hate the planes. And that's the moment to the audience to indicate he doesn't have to do it. There's no point in him going back. He doesn't have to solve this case. He doesn't have to end up in the ocean being shot by a gun. None of the finale needs to happen. And it's a Cassandra moment. It's one of those things that is so good about neo-noirs or noirs in general, which is there's always a point where the protagonist has an opportunity to just go, I don't need to do this. But they never take it because they have to finish the case. They have to see the result.
There's something else as well. There's a ton of visual Chekhov gunnery in this. There's Chekhov guns left and right, and they pay off. One of them is the bottom of the boat being glass. Yeah, not only, you know, you get a view of Epstein Island there for a second.
Oh, my God. I was about to say, are you on the list? Are you on the part of the files?
Well, after this episode, we're all on the fucking list. There's a message here. These are all pieces of shit. Like, it's despicable behavior.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. You notice that there's a moment early in the movie where Mosby's wife gets caught coming out of a movie theater. And the movie that they're going to see is My Night at Maud's, Eric Rohmer film, right? That film is part of a 6-part series called Moral Tales. No one is moral in this movie. Everyone is immoral in this movie. That is the point.
Doesn't Ackman's character say something in regards to a Rohmer film?
I saw a Rohmer film once. It was like watching paint dry.
At the beginning of this movie, telling you this isn't it.
Yes, 100%. I guess this would be the best time for me to reveal the prop that I have. You ready? You ready for the prop?
Oh, yeah, please.
I'm ready.
Go ahead.
This is the chess game that's played in the movie. I don't know if you guys... I set it up and I played it out myself. I set up the actual chess game. So the chess game, the name of this movie is Knight Moves, but in chess you have knight moves, right? And the thing about this chess game that's interesting that Gene Hackman's character really connects with Jennifer Warren's character on. One of the things that I really like about this is that the key move in that chess game is a queen sacrifice. You have to lose the most valuable thing on the board to win, right? And who is sacrificed in this movie? Arlene's daughter, who is the source of all the money. And Gene Hackman says when he's playing the game out, he says, but these moves, these beautiful moves I'm showing you, he didn't play them. He didn't see it. He played different moves and he lost. And then he says he probably regretted it every day of his life. I know I would have. And that queen sacrifice is a clue that Gene Hackman should have picked up on that he missed. And he's going to regret it for every day for the rest of his life. This chess game was literally predicting the ending of the movie in advance, right under his nose. Mm. And I don't think Gene Hackman's character is a very good detective.
No, he's not. It's not. But then it makes him so much more endearing. Flaws make the character relatable. You know this. So that's, I don't know. I think I like him more for it. You know, this is like the dude in The Big Lebowski without the comedy.
He gets an answering machine message from Melanie Griffith's character. And just as she's about to tell him a key piece of information, he turns it off.
His marriage is deconstructing in front of him. It's falling apart. And he's trying to keep it together all the way through this. He's making mistakes because he's going through a separation. And he's trying to keep his shit together.
Agree.
Not to mention the fact that he's got this overhanging thing as an adult of not having dealt with his father issues. As a grown adult. So that it's just a pyramid of bullshit. And it's,
agreed,
you know, it's like a downward spiral. He's going through and he's almost managing to resolve this. In fact, he's seeking resolution of some kind and closure by resolving this case. And like Ricky said earlier, this is not the most important thing. The most important thing is dealing with his marriage and his father issue, whatever. But he thinks that solving another case will get him there. You know, that's good. That adds flavor to this character. It's it's wonderfully flawed.
It's like a British trifle. You get those layers.
No, in my case, it's like a tiramisu. It's like a perfectly layered tiramisu.
Okay, so the important thing here about this is, and you got to catch this because it's so heartbreaking. Mosby goes and seeks his own dad, his birth dad. And he has a heartbreaking moment when he says that I found my dad reading the funny papers and just mouthing the words, right? And in this movie, Hackman's character, the dad to him, is Joey Ziegler. That character is the one he looks up to the most. He sleeps in his trailer. Mm-hmm. He invites him to the football game. He really likes this guy. And when this guy shows up to kill him at the end of the movie, his father figure ends up in the bottom of the water going down in the plane. And what is he doing? He's mouthing words through the glass that Mosby can't hear, just like his dad. And when Hackman is saying that bastard, the bastard, he's talking about his father figure.
It's accurate. It's an accurate interpretations.
And I'm not sure it matters if he lives or dies at the end of this movie, because his heart is broken.
In the conversation, we got a broken man, and I think this is the closest. It's the closest Ackman has got when it comes on to his range of characters, the characters that he's portrayed. You know, I always saw him as the master of sadism, you know, like he does that very well. Because of that Duchenne smile, because of that smile that is menacing. You know, I love it. I miss him so much. I miss him so much. I missed him since the, you know, early 2000s when he stopped acting. People don't understand. If you value this medium, I'm not talking to you, I'm talking to, and you obviously do, if you listen to the show. So to some level, you must, because otherwise you wouldn't listen to three middle-aged men's opinions. You wouldn't. It's heartbreaking to think that's gone forever. It's gone forever. We are now living in an age in which people think that method is useless in acting. And I think that's a fallacy. Yes, it's bad, but it fucking led to great performances. We don't get that anymore because it's not socially acceptable to do that anymore. It's an era. It's the end of an era. And it's a shame because now it's gone forever. So it's tangible. But if you think about it, we lost him 20 years ago, and I feel the same way with Nicholson. Why don't we get any more Nicholson? Because it's over for whatever reason. It could be cognitive abilities. We don't know about the inner workings of these things. I don't think someone like Nicholson went recluse. Because, hey, the career arc of Nicholson and Gene Hackman is very similar. We'll never get that back.
I totally agree. And you know what, Jennifer Warren, when they asked Jennifer Warren what it was like to work with Gene Hackman after this movie, you know what she said? She said, I think he's a miraculous actor. Without any preparation sometimes, he's just always in touch with the truth.
Ratings?
We're close to it. We are close to ratings. But is there anything that we missed here? Do you guys have any factoids or anything? Anything you want to discuss quickly that we missed?
The producer thing.
What's going on, mate?
So We haven't talked about the strange story that happened during the making of this film, which was Quentin's house, which is the character played by James Woods, was actually owned by Phil Kaufman, a road manager for Graham Parsons at the time of his death. During the filming of this, Phil Kaufman was arrested because he followed the wishes of Graham Parsons, which was to just burn his body. He did this illegally. He basically covered the body in petrol and he set it alight and then tried. So he handled a body. He basically stole it from a morgue, put it somewhere out in the desert, burnt the body.
Mate, that's a good friend. All right.
That's a great friend.
Oh, so this is a horror podcast. Excellent.
Yeah, it is. There we go. So the film that was made afterwards, documenting or at least dramatizing this whole thing, was called Grand Theft Parsons.
Oh my God.
It might be available. It might be available on Tubi. Johnny Knoxville's in it, and so is.
You're joking.
Yeah, Johnny Knoxville's in it. It plays Phil Kaufman, so the guy who does the burning of the body.
Was it a dramatization? And yep, in the dramatization,
it was a dramatization. Yeah, it was a dramatization.
That's fucking great.
Christina Applegate's in it somewhere as well. So you know, go find out about Grand Theft Parsons 2003.
Nice one.
So when this was found out, Arthur Penn turned around to Gene Hackman and said, "Man, we're shooting the wrong movie."
Now, I've got a factoid for you. As the movie starts, I'm a sucker for 70s crime funk. That's what I call it. And this movie has a phenomenal score, which, by the way, on the latest transfer, available on the Criterion Collection. Are you aware that Criterion as a company is reviving a lot of... They should sponsor us, man. They should sponsor us. I tagged them. Give us some free movies.
Or at least free access to them. Just give us, like, you know, the link codes, and we can just watch them and be like, oh, we love it. Here you go. We've seen this Criterion film.
So yeah. You want a digital gift from them. Yeah, all right.
Just give me that.
So my investigative work started from the first second of this movie. Because the moment it opens, there's the tune kicking in, and I went, oh, man, that's hitting the groove. I didn't know I needed today. And the sound as well, like the remaster, it's clean, really nice and clean. You know, it's got that perfect 70s grain on it. It's the colors are just right. I don't even think it got treated that heavily. I think it was just well made. The movie was well made at the time. But the sound they did remaster. And the reason why I know this is because as soon as the movie started, I thought, let me pause it for a second. Let me do the promo announcing what movie we're doing next week. And usually on social media, I would put some music in the background. And I need something that is firstly related to the movie. If I can find something, then I'll find something that is evocative of the movie. In this instance, the first thing I did was to Shazam it. And I'm using Shazam, and it's not picking up the theme. It's not finding it. The 1975 film Night Moves does not have a commercial soundtrack album, but its score was composed by Michael Small. Now, the Michael Small soundtrack was never released, and the reason why is because, unlike other films from that era, there is no official soundtrack album available, and the original tapes are believed to be lost. So wow. The entire score for this movie, yeah, and allegedly got stolen.
Oh.
Yes, by disgruntled members of the production. So it's gone forever, and you can't fucking find the score. And I was dismayed because I like it. So if you go on YouTube or whatever and you find somehow, you manage to find some, it's someone that reconstructed it from the movie, and it's not good enough.
Wow.
Yes. Factoid. Mm. Factoid.
That's kind of spooky. Factoid.
Yes.
I have one factoid for you. because Arthur Penn and the writer of this movie, Sharp, were in such conflict, after the movie was released, Sharp did a novelization of the movie. And in the novelization, which a lot of people think is his best, he was a novelist, he's Scottish. A lot of people think the novelization of Night Moves is his best novel. In the novelization, he put back all the things that Arthur Penn took out of the movie. And he sent a copy of the book to Arthur Penn and wrote a note in the front page. And it says, "Do you think there's a movie in this?"
Bitter.
Little bit of post-movie revenge.
I think it's ratings times. George.
Yes, I give this 9.5 spilled Ryan Waters out of 10. This is a really, really special film. And the thing that's happening here that is built into the thing we were talking about earlier about how it's really hard to appreciate this movie on the first watch or without watching it again is it gives the space and time that a lot of movies don't bother. And it's really kind of unique that way. I was in a really difficult period of my life when I first saw this movie. The details aren't necessary, but I was watching movies. I didn't even have a TV. I was watching movies on tablets outdoors, like in bad weather oftentimes. And when I fired this movie up, when I fired a lot of movies that got me through that time up, I would have to pause them to think about what I just seen if something special happened. I never had to do that with Night Moves. Something really extraordinary would happen in it. Someone would say something really interesting, like the whole "where were you when Kennedy was shot" exchange, which is a magnificent piece of dialogue in this movie. And then the movie got quiet. You were walking with the characters. You were hearing the insects in the background. You were hearing the water lapping at the shore. And I didn't have to pause it because while I was thinking about what I thought was extraordinary about what just happened on the screen, the characters were also thinking about what they just experienced as well. Right. So it syncs up with you if you're experiencing some kind of difficult time of your life. This movie can sync up with what you're going through. It's waiting out there as like a really forgotten classic. And because it's not that appreciated and not that well known, you don't have a lot of stuff in your mind when you go into the first watching of it like you do. You don't get stuff from culture about this, right? If you're a person who's never seen Unforgiven, you probably still know things about Unforgiven before you watch it. Night Moves is a totally blank slate for most people when they first come to it. And if you first come to it in a really difficult time, the characters are going to be so relatable to you that it becomes special. But while you're dealing with like what you're experiencing on the screen, the characters are dealing with it at exactly the same time. And whatever that sinking rhythm is between what the people making this movie were trying to figure out and do and get across and the extraordinary level of artistry of the director, the writer, the actors, there's nothing like it. So it's got flaws. It's not well known for a reason. It's a detective movie without a lot of action. When they tried to like market this movie, they didn't even know how to make trailers for it because they were like, we want to put in the action scenes, but the action scenes were fucking weird, right? Because it's a unicorn that way, because it's a broken masterpiece. It's the kind of movie you can turn to when something's breaking in your life. And I think it's extraordinary for that. And there's not a lot of movies that can do that. And most of the ones that are straight dramas or trying to be. I don't think this one was trying to be. I think this one ended up what it was meant to be.
It's accidental greatness.
Accidental greatness, exactly.
Ricky.
I'm really struggling to score this film. There is a lot about this film that I really like. If I took the last 20 minutes of this film, this would easily hit the 9s. If I took the middle section of the film where they go out on the boat at nighttime, it would be a bit of a six. However, there's a lot of scenes in this that I feel like, as George has just said, there's a little bit of brokenness to this movie. There's a little bit of areas that don't seem to connect. I think Umbar saying that, you know, there was a little bit of a mishap between characters at the end of the film. It happened to me as well, because I didn't get the whole MacGuffin storyline. And yeah, it's a MacGuffin storyline, but I didn't get all of the little pieces that were connected to that final MacGuffin storyline. I didn't realize how many people. I actually had to read it up. And maybe George is right. Maybe on a second and a third viewing, it'd be like, ah, those pieces connect now. And so I'm finding it very difficult to score this film, because on this viewing, I was thinking in my head, would I see this film again? I don't know. But through this conversation, I would probably see this film again, because we've started to, in my brain, piece everything together. So I am probably going to give this, I'm going to give this a 7.6 out of 10. I would say a 7.6 borrowed shirt of a broken detective by a 16-year-old.
Oh shit! That shirt's a sentence. That shirt is a sentence. Aye, aye, aye. Did she give you the keys to the city? If that glance was a second longer, I would have had issues with the entire thing, which I do. But it's still kind of, it's a very daring thing to do. It, you know, it touched Lolita's territory, obviously. Yeah. You know, of course. Like I kept drawing those parallels while watching this. Thank you for that. I'm glad that this was gifted to us. And this is such an elitist thing to say, but I think it's difficult to surprise us. And I see that as being a challenge for our guests. In this case, you got to give us an early Christmas gift. I really enjoyed this. I was going to come into this rating with a lower score, just like Ricky. A lot of the stuff I'm going to say now is going to mirror what you said. But the thing is, the third act of this movie completely saved the movie for me. Like the poignancy, again, I am very appreciative. Like I mentioned Paris, Texas earlier. There's a lot of movies of that era. And Paris, Texas is a 90, I said, I always put it in the 70s category for a reason. That's a fallacy. But I don't give a shit. It feels like a 70s feel for me, the way it paces. It's evocative of films like Five Easy Pieces or Common Knowledge, a movie that is very imposing on the viewer, because even by modern standards, you know, to pace at that rate and then give you the final fucking, like the punch is right at the end. You need to stay in. You need to stay. You need to stay for it to get rewarded. So you will be rewarded, you know. It's bad when you watch a movie and it's in position all the way through and the third act doesn't give you that. But otherwise, in this instance, the journey is great, but the ending, from a visual standpoint alone, it's burned into my readiness. To quote Bob Ross, this is a happy little accident. It feels like we're paying tribute to Hackman. This is, by the way, I think the third Hackman movie that we've done. Fourth. We've done The Conversation, we've done Royal Tenenbaums, we've done Unforgiven, now we've done this one, and we will continue to do more.
Great.
I think this is an 8, and it wasn't going to be an 8. I was going to walk into this with a 6.5. So it's an 8 turquoise polo shirts. Sorry for the lack of inventiveness, but that, I'm telling you, the next polo shirt I'm going to buy is going to be a turquoise steel one. And on that note, this was Umba.
This is Ricky.
This is George.
I was a little too tall, could have used a few pounds. Tight pants, points, all the renown. She was a black-haired beauty with big dark eyes and points all her own, sitting way up high. Way up firm and high. Out past the cornfields where the woods got heavy. Out in the back seat of my 60 Chevy. Working on mystery working on our night moves, trying to make some front page driving news, working on our night moves. In the summertime,